Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and in the early hours of Monday the 25th of May, these are the main stories. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu goes on trial facing charges of fraud and bribery. In the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson defends his top advisor, who appears to have broken lockdown rules. And South Africans are warned that the impact of the coronavirus will get worse despite lockdown measures easing. Also in this podcast... the familiar sound of police firing tear gas at protesters returns to the streets of Hong Kong. Israel's longest-serving prime minister has become the first holder of that office to stand trial in a criminal case while still in power, just a week after Benjamin Netanyahu was sworn in as the head of a new coalition government. He arrived at court in Jerusalem to face charges of corruption. Flanked by ministers and bodyguards, Mr. Netanyahu said he was facing the long-delayed proceedings with his head held high. He had the support of these people who had gathered outside the courthouse.
I came here today to support Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Actually, it's not the Prime Minister who's going on trial, it's all of us. We came here to make ourselves heard and to say that you can take us down only through elections, because Benjamin Netanyahu is innocent.
We have no faith in the police and in the court. It's very sad that we got to this situation. We ask and beg the legal system, restore the people's faith in the court, because without it, the country cannot exist.
I spoke to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Tom Bateman, and began by asking him about the charges.
The charges have followed a three-year police investigation. There are three cases, and they focus largely on Mr. Netanyahu's relationships with a couple of powerful media owners in Israel. And the prosecutors really, through the indictment, paint a picture of a prime minister obsessed with his image, so much so that they claim, they allege, he was prepared to do favours, smoothing the path for a lucrative merger, for one, doing business favours or offering to make the law more favourable to a newspaper owner in another case. And in return, that he was getting better media coverage, even in one case that he was alleged to almost have taken editorial control of a popular news website, to the extent it became almost like a PR machine for him and his wife. And in a separate case also, that he, it's claimed, accepted what prosecutors called a supply line of cigars and champagne for an Israeli film producer in Hollywood, and in return that he was doing favours for him as well. Now, he has categorically denied these allegations, and in characteristically combative style today, he said that he was being framed. He called it a political witch hunt, and he said that he was determined to carry on in government fighting coronavirus and protecting Israelis.
You've been outside the court, and talking of combative style, what's it been like?
It was really, I suppose, symbolic of the way in which this trial has polarized Israelis over their view of their longest serving prime minister, just as we've had these political convulsions, three deadlocked elections where they've been unable to make up their mind about him. Now, he's back in government, largely because his main rival in the end said he would join him in government, Benny Gantz. He had always tried to capitalize on the corruption claims, but now joins him in government. And so we saw those divisions really on the streets, both outside his house today in Jerusalem, outside the courtroom as well. Two rival camps, fans and foe, being separated by Israeli border police, and the two groups really vociferous in their, both in their support and in their opposition to Mr. Netanyahu. I mean, I was chatting to protesters. Those who say that this shouldn't be happening, that support Mr. Netanyahu, largely believe that this is a kind of stitch up by the left wing, having put pressure on the police and prosecutors and a liberal legal establishment. They believe that the left can't beat him at the ballot box, so they choose instead to go down this path of prosecution. As for those who really want rid of Mr. Netanyahu, they see this as encapsulating their belief that he's become too powerful. They think he's tried to rig the legal system, even to shield himself himself from prosecution. And that, in their view, I was talking to one protester who felt that this really manifested the end of Israel, the end of democracy, as she put it. So there's really powerful views on both sides who really see symbols in what the country should represent for their side.
Tom Bateman in Jerusalem. To Hong Kong now. That's the sound of tear gas being fired at crowds of protesters angry about China's plans to ban what it calls treason, secession, sedition and subversion in the territory. The proposed legislation has been condemned by more than 200 politicians from around the world as an assault on the city's autonomy. The BBC's Danny Vincent has been speaking to protesters on the street.
Many of the protesters that I've spoken to today, they said that today was somewhat of a stress test. They wanted to see if many people turned up and went out onto the streets, what the police's reaction would be like. They say they've now got an understanding of what the police reaction was like. They also wanted to see how the Hong Kong public would react to calls for yet again more protests. The police acted very quickly today. They didn't wait for very long for the crowds to gather before setting up blue flags, putting blue flags up into the air and demanding that the crowds dispersed. Shortly after that, they fired several rounds of tear gas, and then it descended into a very familiar cat and mouse game where protesters were running around the streets trying to avoid being arrested, and the police officers in riot gear were running down small alleys trying to find these protesters and essentially arrest them. It's certainly the biggest protest we've seen this year. It's also the biggest protest since the outbreak of the coronavirus. Some people say there was thousands. Where I was, there were certainly hundreds of young people and old people. There was also some changes in terms of the slogans they were using, such as people calling for independence. There was one particular expression, independence for Hong Kong, there's no other way. Now that's a slight change here in terms of the protest movement. It has now become a little bit more quiet. There have been calls on social media for people to start going home to save their energy because they believe there's going to be a new round of protests coming next week.
Danny Vincent, at almost exactly the same time as tear gas was being fired, China's foreign minister Wang Yi said there were many reasons why the national security legislation had to be passed as soon as possible.
Since the turbulence over proposed legislative amendments last June, we have seen increasingly rampant activities by Hong Kong independence organizations and radical localists in Hong Kong, escalating violence and terrorist activities, as well as excessive unlawful foreign meddling in Hong Kong affairs. All this has placed national security in serious jeopardy and posed a grave threat to Hong Kong's prosperity and stability and the practice of one country, two systems.
Wang Yi. Here in the UK, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has defended his chief advisor, who admits to driving his family more than 400 kilometres from London to the northeast of England in late March, when the government's advice was stay at home, save lives. Dominic Cummings said he drove to his parents' home because he was worried about childcare for their son as his wife was suffering symptoms. This is what Boris Johnson said.
I think he followed the instincts of every father and every parent, and I do not mark him down for that. And though there have been many other allegations about what happened when he was in self-isolation and thereafter, some of them palpably false, I believe that in every respect he has acted responsibly and legally and with integrity.
But the opposition isn't convinced and is calling for an inquiry. The Labour MP Sarah Jones says there appears to be one rule for ordinary people and another for the Prime Minister's advisor.
Do not leave your home for any reason, was the advice. If you have symptoms, do not leave your home for any reason. There are loads of people who've been bringing food to people who are having to isolate because they've got symptoms. I know a single mother who was really sick and she had to stay at home with her son, who was only 10, and we had to get food delivered to them. People have made these great sacrifices and have had a really difficult time, and we've got the highest death rates in Europe. It's not acceptable to say after the event, oh, actually, the rules meant something which we all know they didn't.
I spoke to our political correspondent Rob Watson moments after Boris Johnson defended his political aide.
It looks like it's one rule for the government laying it down for the rest of the population and another rule for senior advisers. It's simple as that. It's about trust. It's about authority and the sort of sense that the government is saying one thing and doing another. And I should say, just in the last few minutes, Boris Johnson has stood absolutely squarely behind Mr. Cummings, saying that he's acted responsibly with integrity. And one wonders, really, Joe, whether this is the moment that the Prime Minister has dug his own political grave, or whether this is a storm that will pass over. I say that because the anger out there in the country is palpable. Many Conservative MPs are furious, and yet the Prime Minister is staking everything, backing Mr. Cummings.
By the sounds of things, you're surprised that the Prime Minister has stood behind his special advisor, Dominic Cummings. But they have been politically wedded at the hip for 4 years now, haven't they?
I do think this is astonishing high stakes. I mean, people really might look back on this moment as the biggest mistake Boris Johnson has ever made. But not surprised, absolutely, in this sense, that that Mr. Johnson thinks of Mr. Cummings not just as yet another advisor. I mean, the two of them are absolutely joined at the hip. It's very important for everyone to remember that alongside Mr. Johnson, Mr. Cummings is the most important man in British politics. He was the brains behind the Vote Leave campaign, behind Brexit. He was the brains behind Mr. Johnson's decision to call and win the election last December. You know, he is the driving force in government.
Do you think that the fact that senior ministers all backed Mr. Cummings in tweets yesterday, but there have been quite a few backbench MPs not backing him, do you think that will matter?
Absolutely. I think Mr. Johnson has got three problems on his hand. He's got a problem with the British people. I mean, a significant chunk of the British population are going to be very angry indeed. I mean, just look at some of the Twitter stuff. People who said that they wanted to visit a grandparent before they died will now have to go to the funeral. So there's a public relations problem. There's a political problem managing the Conservative Party. And there's an international relations problem. I mean, this just is not going to look very good.
Rob Watson. South Africa has the highest number of cases of coronavirus on the continent, more than 20,000. Now its president, Cyril Ramaphosa, says things could get even worse. Speaking on television, he said some restrictions would be lifted, but warned that a third of all cases had been recorded in the last week. He said people should not be complacent.
I want to emphasize that the easing of some restrictions does not mean that the threat posed by the coronavirus has passed, or that our fight against the disease is over. In fact, the risk of a massive increase in infection is now greater than it has been since the start of the outbreak in our country.
Richard Hamilton has been following this story and told me more.
The reason why Cyril Ramaphosa is warning against complacency is that 4 days ago, a group of experts known as the COVID-19 Modelling Consortium warned that if restrictions were lifted at the beginning of June, the number of cases could rise to 100,000 by August and there would be 40,000 deaths. And they said this is an optimistic scenario and they're looking at a total of 1.2 million cases in South Africa. So quite a grim prediction.
Meanwhile, a gold mine in South Africa has been shut down because workers have been infected with the virus.
That's right. This is the world's deepest gold mine, Mponeng, just west of Johannesburg. 650 workers were tested and 164 turned out to be positive for the virus. AngloGold Ashanti, which owns the mine, says it's being shut temporarily while it's sanitised. Of course, mining is one of the backbones of the South African economy and mines only reopened at the end of last month. But they're also breeding grounds for the virus, as they were in previous days of HIV and tuberculosis.
Richard Hamilton. Still to come in this podcast.
Most of the shops are still closed. All the cafes, bars and restaurants, the cinemas and fitness centres and the parks are shut. But you are allowed outside to go to food shops.
We hear how life has changed in the Russian capital, Moscow, which recorded more than 8,000 new coronavirus cases on Sunday. Afghanistan is experiencing a brief lull in violence, a three-day ceasefire to coincide with the Muslim festival of Eid. In recent weeks, the Taliban had stepped up its attacks on government forces, so its offer of a truce came as something of a surprise. And now President Ashraf Ghani has announced plans to speed up the release of Taliban prisoners. under the peace deal brokered alongside the Americans. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, told Alex Ritson more about this.
In the chaos of a war that is Afghanistan, this is a really exceptional example of how a negotiation should work. You had the first step by the Taliban, huge sigh of relief for the millions of Afghans who were fearing that attacks would mar the Eid celebrations, attacks by the Taliban. It's only a Taliban ceasefire. Then it was followed quickly by President Ashraf Ghani, who recently said his forces were going on the offensive, that they would also reciprocate. And then this morning, another step, which the Taliban have been wanting, which is the expedition of the release of their prisoners. The US Taliban deal signed at the end of February, which the Afghan government was not part of, said that there would be up to 5,000 Taliban prisoners released. And the Taliban need this, first of all, to show the deal was worth doing, but also to show their fighters that they are taking care of their interest. So let's see what happens after the Eid break. There's not much more than 1,000 prisoners which have been released so far. If that goes quickly, there is a chance that they could move now towards what was supposed to follow the US Taliban deal, which is unprecedented talks, official formal negotiations between the Taliban and a delegation from Afghanistan.
Because the Taliban were surprised at how much their fighters liked the truce last time, weren't they?
Yes, so much so that they made sure it didn't happen again. Because what happened last time, and they were memorable moments, the Taliban fighters went into, for example, cities like Kabul, because they knew they had dreams of Kabul in their head. And they ate ice cream. In fact, I met the ice cream seller that they actually met. He said, I didn't just give them free ice cream once, I gave it to the twice. And Afghan women journalists went out and interviewed them, and they did selfies. So this time, the announcement of a ceasefire said that our fighters will not enter enemy territory and vice versa. No hugging of soldiers and Taliban, but I'm sure people will be looking for them to see if they happen at the edges.
Lise Doucette speaking to Alex Ritson. Well, as Lise mentioned, Muslims around the world are celebrating the festival of Eid al-Fitr, although this year's events, which mark the end of Ramadan, will be muted because of the coronavirus restrictions. But in Gaza, where there's been a recent rise in cases, the sight of people crowding these streets at night, flocking to reopened cafes and restaurants, has raised concerns about public health consequences. Suher Zoukout is a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza, and she spoke to my colleague James Kumarasamy.
Since the start of the coronavirus, like by mid-March, after the discovering of the first two cases, the population start to respect the prevention measures. Few cars in the streets, schools were closed, universities, public places. After 2 months of being respecting those rules, Ramadan came and people start to go out, visit relatives and together in the evenings after the sunset. Recently, before the Eid, people rushed to the streets, to the markets. It was a wave of heat also. It's so hard to respect physical distancing, to respect staying at home measures.
Now, you've had a rise in the number of cases, haven't you, in Gaza, and the first death announced as well. Does that make you even more concerned?
Yes. There are 18 quarantine centers in Gaza. The authorities announced 25 cases in one day. And also the first case of death who recently came back from Egypt, an elderly woman who was suffering from chronic illness. But the concern of the International Committee of the Red Cross is that the health system in Gaza is overwhelmed and overstretched by the restrictions of movement, the lack of equipment, lack of medicines, the Palestinian internal differences which affected the capacity of the personnel, the medical teams, to get training and to build their capacity. It's 2 million people living with one of the highest densely populated areas in the world. So one case to be detected outside the quarantine center, it will be catastrophic.
Suher Zoukout speaking to James Kumarasamy. Staying in the region and the city of Bethlehem, where it's been 11 weeks since a coronavirus lockdown was imposed. For people living in the Palestinian West Bank, surrounded by Israeli guard posts and border walls, limits to movement are nothing new. But local residents have drawn on their solidarity and cooperation to cope during the pandemic. Peter Goffin has spoken to community leaders in and around Bethlehem about their efforts.
It's evening in Ida Refugee Camp on the outskirts of Bethlehem. Members of the local youth center have been playing music together on rooftops and at windows, trying to keep spirits high during the lockdown. Ida is home to more than 5,000 people, most of them part of Palestinian families who fled their villages after the creation of Israel 7 decades ago. Living in the shadow of the West Bank barrier that separates Palestinian and Israeli-controlled territories, they've forged a hard-won sense of community.
The people, they were very helpful and they were very good with each other.
Anas Abu Sarur is the manager of the Ida Youth Center.
Many young people, they were like distributing the groceries, the food packages to the poor families and like to the other families who lost their income. They were like cooking in the soup kitchen.
The lockdowns are easing now, but tourism is a vital source of income in and around Bethlehem. And the prospect of international visitors coming back to the Holy Land is still far off. Beit Sahur is known in Christian tradition as the place where the shepherds learned of the birth of Jesus. Rafat Shamali is a member of the town council, but he's also a tour guide.
It's going to be like about till next year till I have my first group, you know. So it's basically, if this is affecting me, it's totally going to affect the whole community. If you read about the history of our town, we were in curfew for 40 days because we refused to pay taxes to the Israeli occupation during the first Intifada. And 40 days, we had to do everything as a community, homeschooling, farming lands, and working all together. So I think this has brought us back to all that time.
The Palestinian authorities that oversee the West Bank have tried to differentiate this coronavirus lockdown from the restrictions long ago imposed by the Israeli government, and to persuade people that these new rules are for their own good. Blockades set up to stop the spread of the virus have been dubbed barriers of love. Video posted to social media has shown guards at these checkpoints singing and sharing messages of hope. And while movement in the West Bank is now more tightly controlled than ever, Palestinians have been able to forge new bonds across communities.
Three, two, go, one.
Right to Movement is a social activism group that uses marathons and organized runs as a form of demonstration. During the lockdown, it's offered fitness classes by video call.
We decided to have a full schedule, 7 days.
The group's co-founder, Diala Asid, moved to Bethlehem at the start of the outbreak to be with her parents.
Like, ironically, we were able to attend workouts that were in Haifa or that were in Jerusalem. And being a Palestinian with a Palestinian ID, I'm not allowed to go to these places like physically, like normally to train with them. But now with this pandemic, we were able to train together online.
Like the concerts in Ida and the food growing and delivery programs across the region, these nationwide classes are a chance for Palestinians to help each other through hardship, to survive in solidarity.
It was Peter Goffin. Russia is among the countries with the most recorded coronavirus cases in the world, although the number of reported deaths is still extremely low. Officials in Moscow put that down to early detection and treatment, but many believe the eventual toll will be significantly higher. Even though the Russian government admits the crisis is far from over, it has begun easing lockdown restrictions. Our Moscow correspondent Steve Rosenberg tells us how he has been coping over the past few weeks.
What can you do when the world turns upside down? When you're locked down for weeks on end. Everyone needs something to help them through this difficult time, this pandemic. For some people, that something might be books, or box sets, or baking. For me, it's music. When I get up in the morning, I play the piano. And the last thing at night, I find it a real comfort. Because when the world out there is so crazy, escaping into the world of music is such a relief. This piece is a famous Russian song. It's called Hope. And this is the world out on the streets of Moscow, near where I live. You can probably hear from all the noise that there is a lot of traffic back on the roads now. But that doesn't mean the lockdown in the Russian capital is over. It isn't. Most of the shops are still closed. All the cafes, bars and restaurants, the cinemas and fitness centres and the parks are shut too. But you are allowed outside to go to food shops. Sveta, привет.
Здравствуйте.
Here I am in Sveta's fruit and vegetable shop. What I love about this place isn't only the delicious apples and pears and carrots and beetroot. It's the fact that rain or shine, pandemic or no pandemic, behind the counter, Sveta is always cheerful. And although I can't see it now because of her face mask, she normally has a big smile on her face. And I reckon that right now we need all the smiles we can get.
В наше время нелегкое, трудное, улыбка всем помогает.
So Sveta says that a smile really helps in this difficult time, and she wants every shopper, every customer to leave with a positive feeling. There you go. One trip to Sveta's fruit shop has given me an idea for what to play at the end. This piece by Charlie Chaplin, Smile.
Our very own Steve Rosenberg tinkling the ivories during lockdown in the Russian capital, Moscow. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham. Until next time, goodbye.